From the early part of the 20th century, aircraft and aerospace manufacturing has been part of the Southern California landscape. But from the boom times of the space race in the 1960s and 70s to the bust after the end of the Cold War, the fascination and wonder of space has continued unabated. Now following in the footsteps of Hawthorne SpaceX are some innovative newcomers in the aerospace field who are leading Southern California back to an age of aeronautic breakthroughs and to the moon, Venus, and beyond. One of the notables, Rocket Lab, is based in Long Beach, but its aspirations are as wide as the universe. And we're finally getting a sense of just how wide that universe is.
James Webb begins a voyage back to the birth of the universe.
The James Webb Space Telescope is the most powerful telescope ever sent into space. The spectacular and detailed images that it reveals are a glimpse straight into the history of the universe. We take a look at some of our recent space innovations as Fox 11 News In Depth starts right now. Hello, everyone. I'm Hal Eisner, and as you can see around me, we're talking today about space. Space, the final frontier, and the ongoing innovations that are changing our world in so many different ways. Our local area has an aerospace component, but it's been kind of up and down over the years. There's a company down in Long Beach shaking up the aerospace world in so many ways, while often dwarfed by big names like SpaceX and Blue Origin. Rocket Lab is quietly going about its business, building launch vehicles, spacecraft, satellite systems, and more. Now, the company is building a large, reusable launch vehicle to work with NASA on interplanetary missions. Peter Beck is the CEO of Rocket Lab. I understand you're joining us from, New Zealand?
Yeah, thanks, Al. Yep, I'm joining you from New Zealand right now.
It's great to talk to you and from so far away. You know, New Zealand isn't nearly as far away as some of those space images we saw just a moment ago. But, you know, in New Zealand, there is a facility perched on a scenic bluff. And I gather that's where you are right now.
Yeah. So that's where we have, you know, two launch pads down in New Zealand and one launch pad in Virginia. At the Wallops, flight facility.
Virginia would be your pad here. The one there in New Zealand, is that the one we're looking at right now?
Yeah, that's correct. Yeah, voted the most beautiful launch site in the world, actually, as well as being, you know, the only private, operational private launch site in the world as well.
Your company, Rocket Lab, has been around a little more than a decade. Is that right?
Correct, yes.
But it's already sort of what they might call a space workhorse, launching more than 100 satellites. That's a bunch.
Yeah. So, I mean, we're actually the second most frequently launched U.S. rocket behind our friends at SpaceX. So, you know, every sort of, 30 days, a rocket rolls off the production line and heads out to the launch site.
The rockets that many of us grew up with, the Atlas V, your rocket started out being much smaller. And why is that?
Yeah, so we basically did, for the small launch industry, the same thing that SpaceX did for the large launch industry. So, before the Falcon 9, it used to cost $100 million or $200 million to put a large satellite into orbit. On the small launch side, it used to cost between $50 and $70 million to put a small satellite on orbit. And we took that from, $70 million down to $7 million. Just like SpaceX took a large satellite from $100 million down to $50 or less. So this kind of dual disruption happened in the industry, one in the big scale and then, of course, one on the small scale.
I'm always fascinated by what they can do with 3D printing. And your rockets are actually made with 3D printing, is that right?
Well, the engines are, yes. You know, we really pioneered that technology. We were the first to ever put a 3D printed rocket engine in orbit. And, we've put 280 3D printed rocket engines into space now. So, we print, the very complex things like engines, but, the rest of the structure, we use carbon fiber form mainly for, the larger parts of the launch vehicle.
That concept of 3D printing is a little mind-boggling to me. But what is it? You're printing out parts in a similar sort of machine?
The Rutherford rocket engine that powers the Electron launch vehicle is almost entirely 3D printed out of Inconel super alloys. And, we started doing that and pioneering that technology when, 3D printing was really being used for things like bottle openers at trade shows and cats prosthetics and kind of really, you know, non-critical or structural things. So it was great to, you know, see that first engine go to orbit, and now within the industry, like 3D printing, you know, rocket engines is you know, a very, very standard thing. In fact, you know, some companies, that's all they do.
You know, recoverability is a big part of all of this, and being able to salvage, repurpose. And so how does that work for your company? You actually have a way you capture the vehicle coming down with a helicopter?
Yeah, trust me, it sounds crazier than it actually is. So, you know, as the rocket, the first stage ascends, it then re-enters the Earth's atmosphere, and we control it very accurately through the Earth's atmosphere. And then we rendezvous with the stage as it's descending under a parachute and collect it with a helicopter and then bring it back for refurbishment and reflight. And, you know, with a small rocket, that's really the only feasible way to do it. A much larger rocket program called Neutron, which is you know, really directly competing with a SpaceX Falcon 9, uses a more traditional approach of propulsive landing back to the launch site or on barges.
Is Neutron, that's the name of the vehicle?
The big rocket.
Kind of like, yeah. Falcon 9 is Elon Musk's vehicle, so yours is Neutron. And so
correct.
Tell us about this Neutron program just a little bit.
Yeah, so I mean, we dominated small launch, and you know, it's really time to move into larger launch, and you know, the vehicle's intended to be a direct competitor with a Falcon 9, and we think there's, you know, it's a really interesting place to play. It's a fully reusable first stage, you know, some of the unique things. If you see a picture of the vehicle, you'll note that it's you know, pretty non-traditional in its appearance. And that's fundamentally because, you know, the rocket is designed to go up just as much as it's designed to go down. And all other rockets in history have been, you know, disposable rockets that have been appended with systems and technologies to make them reusable. Whereas this is, you know, blank sheet design, fully reusable launch vehicle. You know, it looks different as a result.
You know, I got to tell you, for a kid, me, who grew up with the original astronauts, the Mercury 7 program, the launch to the moon, one small step for mankind, yeah, all that stuff. Mm. Space has always amazed me, but it's fascinating to see guys like you taking this to another level. And Peter's going to stay with us. Don't go away, please. Peter Beck with Rocket Lab. Coming up next on Fox 11 News in Depth, we'll be talking more about the company's innovations and the far horizons Rocket Lab is looking at next. We'll be right back. Welcome back to Fox 11 News in Depth. I'm Hal Eisner. Just about a month ago, Rocket Lab announced that it had developed and deployed a satellite for NASA, assisting them on a mission to the moon. The Capstone Project is Rocket Lab's first deep space mission. We're back with Peter Beck, the CEO of Rocket Lab. Peter, was the special thing about the Capstone launch the unique way that the Rocket Lab got the spacecraft into orbit?
Yeah, no, there's just a lot of unique things about the mission. You know, it was the first series of missions, you know, for Artemis in returning to the moon. And, you know, we developed the Electron launch vehicle, obviously. We also developed a spacecraft on the top tool called Lunar Photon. And we used a very unique set of orbital mechanics to accelerate that spacecraft and ultimately fling it out all the way to the moon. And hence, you know, begin the very first part of the Artemis program, returning the first woman and men back to the moon. So, huge, you know, hugely big project, and a great honor to, you know, to fly that mission for NASA.
Do you think you could explain that for a layperson?
Yeah, we built a rocket and we put a spacecraft on the top that flung another spacecraft all the way to the moon. And in fact, we went way past the moon. We're at 1.4 million kilometers away from the Earth right now. But what it really means is, look, for some tens of millions of dollars, we can now go to the moon and do really great interplanetary sciences. We can go to asteroids, we can go to Mars, we can go to Venus. What we really created here was a totally new way to go and visit far-off destinations and planets for tens of millions of dollars instead of, in some cases, billions of dollars. Which the Capstone mission to the moon was obviously a great showcase of the capability, but you know, we're really excited to you know, bring that capability now to market where we can, you know, we can really go deep into space for mission timelines and costs that have never been dreamed of before.
So for Rocket Lab, the moon is the first step.
Yep.
Then?
I've got a bit of a soft spot for Venus, actually. I think Venus is an underrated planet. I think it's a planet that has many, many secrets that need to be unlocked, one of which is pontificated that Venus may have life in the atmosphere. But before we go to Venus, we actually are going to Mars for NASA for another mission called ESCAPADE, where we're building two satellites that will orbit Mars and take measurements of the Martian atmosphere in 2024. So lots of exciting missions. I think a lot of people think of Rocket Lab as a rocket company, and yet we do rockets, and the rockets kind of steal the show. But you know, we build a lot of really cool satellites in our space systems division as well.
You know, I'm fascinated by the idea that Venus has captured your imagination. I always thought Venus was an interesting place as well, but so is Southern California. And so what is the impact of your company on Southern California, employment, all of that sort of economic stuff?
Yeah, well, I mean, you've given me a great segue to say we're hiring because the one thing that feeds the machine is just great talent, and we continue to expand our footprint at a headquarters there in Long Beach. It's not, you know, the one very unique thing is you don't walk in the door and just build rockets. You can turn to the left and build rockets, and turn to the right and build spacecraft that are going to Mars. So we really love the environment there.
You know, we talk about the idea that we had an enormously impactful aerospace industry here, and sort of after the Cold War we went bust. And tell us sort of what your sense is of aerospace now in Southern California.
Well, look, growing up as a kid, you know, I wished I was living, you know, when you were living, Hal. I believed that the Apollo missions were the pinnacle of human kind of exploration in space, and the most exciting time to be involved in the space industry. But the reality is that now is the most exciting time in history. You have tremendous opportunities, lots of opportunities within lots of different companies. And as an aerospace engineer or just a space enthusiast, your ability to actually have impact has never been as great as it has since Apollo time. So I really believe that this is the most amazing time to be alive. And commercial has taken over so many of the duties that typically large government programs have. And the opportunities for everyone now are just are almost unlimited. Whether you want to work on something that goes to Mars or work on a giant rocket, like you choose.
Well, just real quick, because we have less than a minute here, but one of the things I always found compelling was the astronauts. They sort of gave a face to what was going on, and now we have sort of these devices like Falcon, Neutron, Electron, Proton. It's almost like you create a cast of characters that can become connected to the public. And that really helps drive the space program. So as a final thought, where are we going?
Well, I think there's no argument as a species, human spaceflight is going to become more and more prolific. And I think as we explore our own solar system in the universe, I mean, James Webb Telescope is a great example, unlocking the histories of the beginning of time. It's very difficult not to be excited about those kinds of things, because I think, fundamentally, we all want to know where we came from, and we all believe in exploration. If you track human history throughout the beginning of time, whether it's sailing across the seas or exploring the universe, we're built to explore, and we're built to learn.
I made the mistake once of asking Carl Sagan if he thought there was life out there in the universe, and he looked at me and said, "You have to be made of wood not to believe that there's life out there in the universe." Peter Beck, thanks for joining us. Coming up next on Fox 11 News In Depth, the James Webb Telescope is sending back spectacular photos of the universe. They're beautiful, but what do they mean? We talked to a planetary scientist about why the web is changing our worldview. We'll be right back. Welcome back to Fox 11 News In Depth. I'm Hal Eisner, and we've recently been seeing some spectacular images from the $10 billion James Webb Telescope. It really lets us look deeper into space than humanity ever has. Joining us right now, Dr. Tiffany Kataria is with, and she's with JPL. Hi. How you doing?
How are you, Hal?
I'm great. I'm like a kid in a toy shop here with all this stuff about space, because I'm fascinated.
So are we.
I'm fascinated by this subject, and you're involved with exoplanet discovery in science. And so, what is exoplanet?
Sure. So exoplanets are planets that orbit other stars outside of they exist outside of our solar system. So there are big ones, small ones, you know, more maybe Earth-like, more Jupiter-like, and really in between. And so my research centers on not just discovering them, but trying to understand, you know, what their atmospheres are made of and how they might have formed and evolved.
Well, currently, from what I'm told, there are more than 5,000 of these exoplanets out there. And it's one of the things that the James Webb Telescope has been looking at and capturing. And, you know, it's a pretty remarkable telescope. We have an image here. It's the newest image to come out. Looks a little bit like a cartwheel. What is this, a cartwheel galaxy?
Yeah, so, and I think this is really hot off the presses, right? This just came out, I think, yesterday. And so this is the cartwheel galaxy with two companion galaxies aside it. The thought of this cartwheel galaxy, which is the big one that resembles a wheel, is that it was actually produced by the collision of two galaxies, and that's why there's all this dust and gas being strewn around. And so it's up to, you know, scientists like us to try and interpret the observations, get spectra, try and split up the light into characteristic wavelengths to try and understand, you know, not only what they look like, but what they're made of.
Yeah, you know that emoji where the head is exploding?
Yes.
No, I mean, it's amazing to me. We always think everything's about us and we're the center of the universe. And so, you know, oh, there's the moon. Oh, I see some stars. But that thing is out there?
Yeah, it's a very humbling experience. And I mean, you say, you know, head explode emoji, you can imagine what the room of, you know, scientists all over NASA centers where their heads were exploding simultaneously, figuratively speaking.
Well, it's kind of like you're cleaning off your windshield or you're doing something to clean off your glasses. That's what this telescope does. It gives you a much clearer image, right?
Absolutely, and that has to do with JWST's greater sensitivity in the infrared wavelengths. So these wavelengths where you're sensitive to temperature and radiation, and so you're able to peer through a lot of the gas and dust that has inhibited previous telescopes, for example, the Hubble Space Telescope.
I don't remember the Hubble putting out images this crisp.
Yeah, so it's not just the sensitivity, but also the clarity, the resolution of the images. So not only are you seeing more deeply, but you're seeing a more clear picture than what's been presented before.
The Hubble on the left.
That's
and on
right.
the right, the Webb.
The Eagle Nebula, yeah, shown in the left with Hubble and in the right JWST. And it's very clear there that with Hubble, there's a lot more gas that's kind of shrouding that nebula. And so you can't really peer as far into the nebula or the image. But with JWST, we have the capability not only to see farther, but to see with much higher resolution.
James Webb begins a voyage back to the birth of the universe.
And so there's that question we often ask in news. Why should we be concerned? Why should we care? Why should we feel good about this? Why?
I mean, you know, at the end of the day, we want to understand where we come from, what we're made of, how unique we are in the universe. Personally, something I'm interested in is trying to find Earth 2.0. Are we alone in the universe? And JWST will be able to start making footsteps towards answering that question.
What have you learned that absolutely blew your mind?
Right now it's fast and furious in terms of new discoveries that are being made. I'm part of a lot of big teams that are getting some of the first observations, for example, of exoplanets. And so, you know, it's a scramble to just try and, you know, we're like kids in candy stores, like you said, you know, throwing all of our models, our analyses at these data sets to try and understand, you know, what it is we're seeing. And there are going to be so many unexpected discoveries that are going to come out of these images, these spectra. And I have no doubt whatsoever that JWST will revolutionize our understanding of the universe.
They look like art. They look like wall art.
They really do. They really, really do. And in fact, I've been using the Carina Nebula image as my, you know, WebEx Zoom background, you know, at every meeting I have, and printed them on some T-shirts. You know, they're just, I mean, stunning to look at, but the amount of science that's really embedded in all of theirs.
We have another image here. It's known as the WASP-96b. Tell us about this one.
Sure. So what you're seeing is actually what's called a spectrum of an exoplanet, so planets outside of our solar system. And so with the JWST, we have spectrometers that essentially split up the light like you would, you know, like a prism would split up light to form a rainbow. That's essentially what we're doing here. And so this graphic is showing the spectrum of that planet's atmosphere. And so what modelers have shown is that there are these signatures of water. Those are the bumps and wiggles that are indicated over there.
It's good work you guys are doing out there, and keep sending those pictures back. I'm enjoying them.
Absolutely.
Thanks so much being with us. And coming up next on Fox 11 News In Depth, much more. Be right back. And finally, if you haven't already, please check out my podcast. It's called What the Hell, and it's available wherever you subscribe to podcasts, or just go to whatthehellpodcast.com. That's it for this week's Fox 11 News In Depth. Thanks so much for joining us. Have a great week, and see you next time.